it's just a very important component to serving rural Alaska. And it cuts across the private sector. It cuts across state government.
Bypass mail could be targeted as the post office looks to trim its budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the school voucher legislation skips the Education Committee.
I learned an important lesson last Friday. Never, never, never leave town.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. What started as an idea in 1995 is now 1,000 strong. Learn more at ansep.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Power has been out in the village of Tuliksac for the past few days. The village is located 50 miles upriver of Bethel. From member station KYUK in Bethel, John Active reports.
On Tuesday, Tuliksac Native Community President Waskoff Lai said the one generator in the village was no longer operational. It is believed that the electric generator burned out after overheating. Witnesses say a piston broke through the side of the cylinder. The generator was located in a newly built powerhouse in the village. Fly said he did not know when the village would get power back up and running. The village has not been able to sell any gasoline or stove oil to the residents because of the power outage. Residents without wood heat are staying at the Tuliksac School, which has its own power generator. Wind chills on Tuesday dipped to 50 below zero. Today, the Alaska Energy Authority in Anchorage confirmed that they were helping the village but would not comment further. In Bethel, I'm John Active.
The U.S. Postal Service recently announced an end to Saturday delivery. People will stop receiving letters on Saturdays by the end of summer. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, a postal reform bill is expected before then, and bypass mail will likely be targeted for reforms.
Seven short words in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution assure that everyone in Alaska will receive their mail. The Congress shall, the Constitution reads, establish post offices and post roads. In 1971, Congress mandated a sea change. The Postal Service now needed to function as a self-sustaining business without federal dollars. A year later came another change, bypass mail. The Postal Service would pay private air carriers to deliver mail and packaged goods to bush communities in Alaska, bypassing the Postal Service completely. Stephen Hatter is Deputy Commissioner at the Alaska Department of Transportation. He says the state does not pay anything for bypass mail.
It's just a very important component to serving rural Alaska, and it cuts across the private sector. It cuts across state government. There are other agencies besides Alaska Department of Transportation that both benefit from and are interested in the long-term outcome of policy with bypass mail.
That public policy Hatter mentions is federal. Bypass mail is a partnership between the Postal Service and the Federal Department of Transportation. DOT sets the rates, and the Postal Service pays for the program. It's bleeding money, and it has been since the program began. A USPS Inspector General report showed the bypass system lost more than $70 million in 2010.
There are some inherent inefficiencies in it.
Daryl Issa is a San Diego area Republican who chairs the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Long a critic of bypass mail, he now says the government needs to maintain the program. Issa traveled to and around Alaska last year without any of the Alaska congressional delegation alongside him. He came back a convert, saying he sees the necessity of the program. One of the bypass inefficiencies he's looking to change is the requirement that planes carry both freight and people. The post office pays four large carriers and 22 smaller ones to deliver the packages. In turn, it assures a steady stream of flights to smaller airports. Critics say it subsidizes the aviation industry at a cost to anyone who pays for stamps. Postage is the only way the post office makes money. ISA says he'll look at the frequency of flights and which planes the carriers are sending to different airports.
We have small amounts. The dual use makes a lot of sense.
Because, he says, if there's not much mail, it makes sense to sell more seats.
In some cases, where you have a 737, a freight going every single day, it may not make sense to make sure that there are seats on every single flight.
ISA did not say whether he'd push to require the state to contribute to the program. The notion alone scares Stephen Hatter.
We don't really want to get into what ifs in terms of the state picking up any subsidies at some point.
People on Capitol Hill say a reform bill will need to come before July. Last Congress, the Senate passed a version, only to see it founder in the House. Senator Mark Begich says he's ready to make another go.
I will do everything I can to ensure that what we passed last year, which protected bypass mail, will continue this year.
But the real fight in postal reform will not be whether the post office pays for a program it doesn't operate, but over congressional requirements that the Postal Service pay future benefits for future retirees. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The normally dry subject of committee referrals is creating a bit of a stir in the state capitol. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Last week, a group of five senators introduced a resolution to amend the Alaska Constitution to allow for a school voucher program. The measure was supposed to be heard in the Education Committee. That is, until it suddenly wasn't, as Senator Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak and chair of the Education Committee, discovered while traveling in Kentucky on business.
I learned an important lesson last Friday. Never, never, never leave town. No matter how calm and uneventful you think things will be in your absence, don't believe it. Stay in Juneau until the bitter end.
The voucher resolution was removed from his committee and will instead be heard in Judiciary and Finance. A similar resolution to strike language from the Constitution that prohibits direct funding of religious schools stalled in the Education Committee during the last legislature. During the Senate floor session on Tuesday, Stevens described the voucher question as the most momentous education issue that he had encountered during his years in the legislature. He also announced that he would hold hearings on the issue of vouchers, even if his committee wasn't processing the measure.
I don't know the answer to the question of whether vouchers will be good for Alaska or not good for Alaska, but we will do our best to find the right answer without prejudice and without emotion, but with civility and respect for all opinions.
The legislature already held a hearing on education reform earlier this month, and the four experts invited to speak all advocated for vouchers. Stephen says he doesn't believe in bottling up legislation just because he doesn't support it.
I have no objection to the resolution being moving ahead, though I don't personally agree with it, and I would, if eventually it makes it to the ballot box, probably vote against it based on our constitutional principle of separation of church and state. You see, Mr. President, I really like the First Amendment to the Constitution. I like it a lot.
When talking about the constitutional question of funding religious schools, Stevens quoted James Madison to back up his position. He also cited Alaskan founding father Jack Coghill, former lieutenant governor and father of Senator John Coghill, a co-sponsor of the voucher resolution and the current judiciary chair. I stopped by the younger Coghill's office later that day to find out what he thought of the resolution. He jokes that he doesn't mind having his father's arguments used in opposition to his own, and when I ask him about the referral process, he gets up from his desk.
So let me get the Constitution real quick. Constitution says, no money shall be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. That's the part that is to be amended out. So it's really, can money go for other purposes than what we're doing now?
Coghill, a Republican from Fairbanks, says that the way he sees the process going, the resolution would get consideration from the Judiciary and Finance Committees and then appear on the floors of the House and Senate. If 2/3 of the legislators voted for it, it would go to the ballot, where a majority of voters would need to approve it. Coghill says that if it passes and the legislature starts talking specifics on a voucher program, that's the obvious place for the Education Committee to jump in.
So what Senator Stevens is saying is accurate and probably one of the debates. But we can't even have that debate until we ask the people, can we have that debate? And he says it's unconstitutional. Well, he's right in that our Constitution now has that barrier.
Coghill also says he understands why Stevens would like the Education Committee to get involved in the debate sooner rather than later. Senate President Charlie Huggins, who made the move to skip education, has said the voucher resolution could once again be referred to education down the road. This isn't the first time this session that committee referrals have been questioned. Last week, Senate Democrats objected that a bill defining what qualifies as a medically necessary abortion was not referred to the Health and Human Services Committee, and that a measure concerning the development of a hydroelectric site in a state park was not directed to resources. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the effort to clean up the mess World War II left behind on Attu Island.
There's Bunker C, and there's lubricants, and there's different oils, and there's diesel fuels.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic mammogram results to patients within one working day, led by Drs. Denise Farley and Heather Tauschik. PROVImaging.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Attu Island is long overdue for some spring cleaning. 70 years after World War II, the island is still littered with shards of old Coke bottles, lead-based batteries, leaking fuel drums, and unexploded artillery. This summer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages the remote island as a refuge, will survey the extent of World War II debris and contamination. As KTOO News intern Kelsey Gabrowski reports, the entire ecosystem could be affected by the decades of pollution.
Attu gave biologist Deborah Rudis goosebumps. Until her first visit to the island in 2007, Rudis had only seen Attu's past while sifting through decades of documents for her job at Juneau's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office. She plans to return this summer with a team of other scientists to catalog the cleanup work that needs to be done. Rudis says evidence of military occupation sticks around on Attu.
It's such a wet environment that all that surface water continues to flow and meet the creeks and go downstream. In a few places, you just kind of kick into the edge of the stream bank and you could release some product coming out into the water, and you'd see the oil slick just move downstream.
During her 2007 visit, Rudis shared the island with a few Coast Guardsmen and two other biologists. Now, the Coast Guard station is closed. She is a contaminants biologist and was on Attu to survey the pollution. She calls the hydrocarbon pollutants product because there's more than just oil.
There's Bunker C, and there's lubricants, and there's different oils, and there's diesel fuels.
World War II's Aleutian campaign is sometimes called the Thousand Mile War. The U.S. military built a base on Attu and deployed 15,000 U.S. troops there. Rudis says about 2,000 Japanese soldiers dug into the ground or navigated caves for shelter. Cliffs and mountains separated the two bases. The U.S. retook Attu from the Japanese in 1943 in the only World War II battle on American soil. Rudis followed the trail of troop supplies while surveying Attu. She counted thousands of fuel barrels, many so rusted only the skeletal rings remained. Their contents had pooled and solidified, creating an asphalt lot in the middle of the Aleutian tundra, an example of the pollution of war.
When World War II was over, they just left it. And even in the 70s and the 80s, when the Navy or other military entities left other places in the Aleutians, they left it behind. They left their buildings, they left the coffee cups on the table, they left their papers. It's amazing when you go in there and you see this stuff. Now, in Attu, most of it's pretty well gone and decayed, but the contaminants were not considered an issue, and of course they wouldn't have been back then because it was a war situation.
Unexploded ordnances also litter the island, but are marked sporadically. Rudis says a naval disposal unit tried to minimize the risk of explosive accidents, but the plan backfired.
They thought it could blow them up and it would neutralize them, so to speak, but a lot of things don't totally blow up or they're buried in the bottom of the pile.
Attu is one of about 10,000 formerly used defense sites nationwide. The Department of Defense has about $250 million each year to whittle away at some of the 2,700 sites that need cleaning up. Cleaning up the Attu site could cost tens of millions of dollars and stretch out more than a decade. Kenneth Andrashko is the manager of formerly used defense sites in Alaska. He says it could be 2 to 5 years before an Attu cleanup would get underway. The Fish and Wildlife Service will fund this summer's survey.
We don't own that land. We don't manage that land, we being the Department of Defense. Fish and Wildlife might have to look at some of the areas to determine what they want to keep, what is culturally significant to them, what areas they want disturbed, not disturbed, before the Corps of Engineers, on behalf of DOD, goes in and does a remediation.
Fish and Wildlife Service historian Debbie Corbett will join Rudis and the other scientists this summer to survey old Attu battlefields for the first time. She has been to Attu before to study Aleut artifacts.
It's sort of like a World War II version of Gettysburg, where you've got the troop movements and the actual battle. You can see where the battle was fought.
Corbett says World War II artifacts weren't seen as old or special enough to preserve until recently. She aims to leave things where they're found whenever possible. Where she finds an object helps her understand how it was used and what was around it.
I'm trying to get people to think of this as a landscape, not just as isolated objects on the ground or cluster of buildings or a runway, but the whole thing as a unified picture.
This summer, the Fish and Wildlife team will get to Attu by sea. The Coast Guard station's abandoned runway needs a safety check before planes can land. The Corps of Engineers is making it a priority to clean up Attu before the runway decays, eventually reclaimed by the tundra. For K2, I'm Kelsey Gabrowski.
We've all heard politicians talk about how businesses need to change to succeed in today's marketplace. A group of Alaska entrepreneurs shared their success stories in hopes of inspiring others at last week's Innovation Summit in Juneau. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Most of us have heard stories of an Alaskan with an idea for a business that just takes off. There's the boatyard that became a major tour operator, or the beer lovers who now sell in more than a dozen states. Representatives of five of those businesses talked about how they made it work during the Innovation Summit. One is a business that provides flexibility needed for local hire. Huna Totem Corporation Board Chairman Russell Dick says its Icy Strait Point tourist attraction does just that. He says the seasonal business employs village residents who don't want a year-round job.
Nobody lives in these rural communities to work for a Microsoft. That's up there. I mean, their idea of lifestyle compatible is the ability to go deer hunting, the ability to go berry gathering, to do these things that make living in a rural community just critically important to them.
Dick is also president and CEO of Ha'ani, a Sea Alaska subsidiary pursuing economic development in Southeast. It's been helping village residents set up oyster farms and sell their product. He says it's a collaborative business model, not a grant program.
We, as a for-profit entity, we're willing to put money into this, we're willing to put time, but we're not going to solve the problems within the region.
Another innovator is Alan Marine, based in Sitka. The family-owned business began as a ship repair yard. It fixed up a derelict boat and began providing tours. Growing demand led the company to buy, then build more vessels. Wildlife viewing excursions expanded to Juneau and Ketchikan, and the company eventually formed its own small cruise line, Alaskan Dream. Vice President Jamie Cagle says its onboard shops are part of its business plan.
We try and support and procure as many local products as we can, you know, whether it be the foods on board or the gifts that we do. And we found that to be a very successful program for us. It's what our customers like to see, and the quality's good.
Yet another innovator is a much larger company, Anchorage-based Alaska Communication Systems. ACS CEO Anand Vadapelli says his company took a new direction by partnering with a longtime competitor.
For those of you who've been in Alaska at least 10 years or more, you have a sense of the degree of competition and rivalry that exists between ACS and GCI. Well, guess what? Last year, ACS and GCI announced a joint venture to combine our wireless networks together to form the single largest wireless network in the state of Alaska.
That, he adds, is to compete against telecom giant Verizon, which plans to begin service in the 49th state this year. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, committed to Alaska for nearly 60 years. From basketball games to sled dog races, Crowley supports events that bring Alaskans together. Crowley supports what matters, and public radio matters. CPDAlaska.com. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Tanana Chiefs Conference has gathered leaders from interior Alaska Native villages in Fairbanks to talk about Yukon River salmon. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, there's frustration with the depressed state of Yukon River Chinook stocks.
The TCC Fish Summit has tribal representatives, fishery managers, and biologists talking about recent years' weak king salmon runs that have prompted fishing restrictions and how to turn things around. Village residents like Julie Roberts Heislip of Tanana voiced a common sentiment at the summit that the government is not helping.
Our people have been making sacrifices for years. How much more can we give up?
One of the founders of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, Tom Kriska of Fairbanks, agrees. Kriska says the current research is a rerun of the past 20 years and needs to shift to look at ocean survival.
I think they should more focus once the fish leave the river. They know they come in here, they hatch, and they leave. They go back out to the seas. So once they're, I don't know how you track them from there, but I mean, at least they'll have an idea where the fish goes or what happens.
State of Alaska Yukon Area Fisheries Biologist Stephanie Schmidt responded to the research issue during the meeting, saying a $10 million Chinook salmon study initiative from Governor Sean Parnell includes looking at migrating smolt.
What areas are they utilizing at the mouth of the river? What kind of resources are available to them? How is temperature or climate change or increased flow and rains influencing their survival? Because that first year out in the ocean, out along the coast, is very critical to their survival.
Salmon bycatch in the commercial Bering Sea pollock fishery has long been blamed for the demise of king stocks. Recent years' regulations have dramatically reduced the incidental harvest in U.S. waters. But Nulato First Chief Michael Stickman says the issue transcends the domestic fleet.
The pollock industry is not only American, it's Russian, Asian. You know, we have heard rumors that their bycatch is 10 times the American bycatch. And only the American bycatch is monitored. The foreign fleets, nothing.
Stickman says the situation has been made worse by mismanagement of the Yukon River fishery and suggested fishermen sue the state. Tanana Chiefs Conference Wildlife and Parks Director Orville Huntington of Hooslea acknowledges frustration but says some of the criticism is unbased.
Just the lack of understanding. I think if they would have stayed around for the whole meeting and heard the things that we've done since 20 years ago. I mean, I got my college degree since then. You know, they have one of their own, you know, with a wildlife biology degree advocating for them.
He says it's up to tribal leaders to help brainstorm research projects and short-term coping solutions in anticipation of another weak Yukon King run and fishing restrictions this summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Imagine a domesticated salmon raised on land and eating plants. Depending on your point of view, it's a nightmare or a dream on the edge of becoming true. APRN contributor Johanna Urich reports on research discussed this week at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Boston.
Turning salmon into vegetarians is harder than growing them in freshwater tanks on land. Stephen Sommerfeld works for the Conservation Fund Freshwater Institute, which is already marketing systems to do the job. With $30 million and 5 acres, each of his customers are installing systems that can raise 3,600 tons of salmon that get to market 9 months faster than the net pen-reared Atlantic salmon.
That's because we have the ideal water temperature and the ideal water quality for the fish year-round.
The tanks can be built anywhere near where fish are bought. Their designers say the tanks recycle most of their water and the waste can be used as fertilizer. By operating on land, the risk of disease outbreaks spreading to wild stocks is eliminated. The two are not likely to meet outside of a taste test. Weaning salmon from eating other fish is a bigger challenge than designing a closed system, but the research is moving ahead rapidly. Margaret Overland with the Norwegian University of Life Sciences points to commercial fish feeds used in Norway, the world's largest producer of farmed salmon, that already have as little as 10% fish meal. Her team successfully uses microbes, microalgae, and yeast to substitute for the remaining fish meal. The scientists say it's neither the fish nor the animal plankton that make omega-3 fatty oils. They are actually produced by microalgae. Overland isn't stopping there. She's trying to feed salmon spruce trees or sawdust.
That's an interesting concept, and the technology allows us to do this. I think the future fish feed will be more and more based on materials that don't compete directly with human foods, and this is where the microbial ingredients do come in.
Researchers like Overland have set themselves the task of doubling the world's food supply in the next few decades. Jeff Silverstein with the U.S. Department of Agriculture says that will require growing food in the ocean as well as land. He says to meet the challenge of feeding the world, we need to get beyond the parochial battles over wild versus farmed fish and develop the technology to produce protein with the minimum impact on the environment.
Every system of sustainable intensification is going to need to be explored.
Fish protein is the most efficient animal protein on the planet, and raising them is more efficient than chasing after them in the wild. But what about the taste?
They grow so well and so fast that they're depositing a lot of fat marbling in the fillets. It's a fresher product.
Having said that, Stephen Sommerfeld, who sells fish farms, also admits that he still comes up to Alaska to catch wild salmon. I'm Johanna Urich.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Active in Bethel, Kelsey Gabrowski and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Johanna Urich in Boston. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Join in the excitement and the love of art at the Alaska Public Television Art Auction. Take a look at the paintings, drawings, mixed media, and sculptures from Alaskan artists online at alaskapublic.org. Be sure to watch KAKM Channel 7 for the Alaska Public Television Art Auction starting Thursday night from 7 until 10. And join us in the studio Friday and Saturday. All proceeds benefit KSKA, APRN, and Alaska Public Television. Information at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.